Okay, good evening, everybody, and welcome back for the third part of our series on morning and halacha. Tonight's shiur, the morning light perspectives on avelus and halacha and hashkafa, did not seem quite as bold of a task when I was just making up the titles several months ago. When I actually sat down to prepare an outline and try to fill in that outline for tonight's shiur, I realized that may have bit off more than I can chew. Originally, and this is, actually what I'm going to try to deliver on tonight, so give an overview of the different stages of Avelus, of Shiva, and Shloshim, and for a parent, Yud Beis Chodesh, and as well try to create some philosophical context in which we can understand and appreciate and gain deeper insights into the various laws of Avelus. If I could do it all again, which I'm not going to at this point, but hopefully at a later date there'll still be opportunities to do so, probably break this up into two shiurim, because the halachos alone, even on a very, very simple, superficial level, can take up easily more than an hour. So, that being said, we're now going to try within an hour less to do just that. But as I've said in the past, I ask you to appreciate that, this is an attempt to pack in a lot of information in a relatively short period of time, and therefore we should hopefully be inspired to learn more and to gain a clearer, deeper insight and perspective at later dates, particularly for those who are interested in actually walking away with halacha lamaseh and really want to know some of the details of avelus, to understand and appreciate that this is not to be understood as exhaustive in that respect. I want to begin with an introduction. I'm sorry, that's a little small. Most of the fonts will be big. Most mitzvos that we perform have two components to it. They have what's called a masa mitzvah and a kiyama mitzvah. The masa mitzvah means the action of the mitzvah, and the kiyama mitzvah is what would probably best be translated as the fulfillment of the mitzvah. And most mitzvos have both of these components, and typically they merge into one and are actually achieved simultaneously. So, for example, when it comes to the mitzvah of netilas lulav, the action of taking the dalet minim basically constitutes the kiyum, the fulfillment of that mitzvah. When I take the lulav and esrog together with the other two minim together on the Yom Tov of Sukkot, so by doing so, I am a kayim the mitzvah. Now, of course, there are kavanos, there are certain intentions that a person can have in mind to enhance that experience. There are proper ways, the chachila, and ways that are accepted would be the evidence to fulfill the mitzvah, but ultimately, the action is what constitutes the fulfillment of the mitzvah. Another example, a concrete example, when it comes to the mitzvah of achilas matzah. The action of eating the matzah is the action through which one automatically fulfills the mitzvah. So the achilas matzah essentially constitutes the kiyum of the mitzvah. Another example, when it comes to the mitzvah of lachas ner Chanukah, as the Gemara tells us, the hadlaka of the ner is osa mitzvah, that's what does the mitzvah. So the action of lighting the candle, that constitutes the kiyum of the mitzvah. However, Rav Soloveitchik explained there are times when the masa mitzvah and the kiyama mitzvah are bifurcated. They are separated. And in this situation, the physical execution of the mitzvah does not automatically constitute fulfillment. Rather, the fulfillment of the mitzvah requires a particular state of mind. These mitzvahs have an expression that Rav Soloveitchik spoke about at length in different contexts called the kiyum shivaleis. Remember those other mitzvahs that we mentioned, lulav and matzah, and halakas ner Chanukah, to name a few, there was not a kiyum belave. The kiyum was not in one's heart. Rather, a person did a mitzvah, and the action constitutes the fulfillment. But there are other mitzvahs that have a kiyum shebelave. Some examples would be tefillah. There are actions of davening, which include, of course, saying the words. One doesn't have to hold the sitter, but you go through the sitter, you turn the page, you say the words. Sometimes you stand, sometimes you sit. There are many, many laws having to do with how a person should be dressed and one's state of mind and where one should be and the order and the sequence, disruptions. Those are all part of the actions of the mitzvah. But ultimately, as we can all appreciate, tefillah is a mitzvah that requires kavana, and a tefillah without kavana, as Chazal said, it's like a guf, it's like a body without a neshama. So this is what's called a mitzvah that has a kiyum shevelev. Another example, sort of salivation, is Simchas Yomtiv. There are actions that are associated with Simchas Yomtiv, and over here in this picture, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to remind ourselves that today we don't have the full experience of Simchas Yomtiv without the Beit HaMikdash, but of course today we have Basar V'yayin, other individuals experience Simchas Yom Tov in other ways. But ultimately, Simchas Yom Tov is something which is achieved in one's heart. It requires a kiyum, it has what's called a kiyum shebeleiv. Tshuva is another example. Of course, there are actions that are associated with tshuva. Most importantly, vidui, the actual verbal expression, articulation of one's sins. But at the end of the day, if a person is seeking to fulfill the mitzvah of tshuva, to repent genuinely, there has to be an emotional experience as well. So it's a kiyum shebeleiv. For the purpose of our discussion this evening, I'm going to present with you with a final example. Rav Soloveitchik said the same is true when it comes to Avelos. The actions of Avelos, we're going to talk tonight about some of the particulars, the halachos, which can sometimes be technical, very practical, and maybe even seem mundane, ultimately this creates a context for what should be a mitzvah which augments and enhances and comes together with experience in one's heart. And as a result, through this, the person achieves the kiyum shebeleiv, the kiyum of Avelos. Rav Soloveitchik, who we've been quoting from over the past couple of weeks, has a quote, I believe this may have actually come from last week's presentation, in which we differentiated the demarcation between aninus and Avelos. That when a person is an onen, so they're experiencing the very, very raw and sudden shock of death, and as a result, the halacha doesn't merely relieve one, but completely excuses one entirely from having to fulfill mitzvos, because at that moment the person is completely preoccupied, not just in a technical sense, but that person feels a sense of complete disconnect from God, from spirituality perhaps. A person feels, you know, in a sense of despair, what's the point of it all? And shortly thereafter, actually right at the time, as the Rav said that the Kaddish is being said, by the burial, there's a transformation that is to take place, and a person transitions from aninus into avelus, which the Rav said with the commencement of avelus, the halacha commands the mourner to undertake a heroic task, to start picking up the debris of his own shattered personality and to reestablish himself as man, restoring lost glory, dignity, and uniqueness. This doesn't happen weeks and months after a person experiences death, but in some cases, hours at most, ideally, a day, not more. For this process, this transition to take place. Avelus is not just a way of expressing how sad we are, but part of the experience of Avelus is a means to help a person, carry a person from one stage to the next. An important question that we can ask about Avelus in general, but Shiv in particular, is for whose benefit? After all, who is the subject for which Avelus, or Shiva in particular, is serving? Is it the Avel, the Avelim, the mourners, or is it the deceased? You know, who is the center? Who is the focal point of Shiva? Now, time doesn't allow to bring all the proofs that we could bring to make a case for both, but we'll cut right to the punchline and say that the answer is it's both. There's a duality that's inherent within Shiva, that both the Nifter, the deceased, and the Avelim, and the mourners are, in a sense, being served through the process of Shiva in different ways. And this is not necessarily the best proof, but a very concrete source where you'll see this come together comes from the Rambam. The Rambam writes that yearly, it seems to me, Shenachamas Avelim Kodem L'Bikur Cholim. If a person has two mitzvos in front of him, and he has to choose which takes precedence, Nicham Avelim, visiting a mourner and trying to console the mourner, or visiting one who is sick, it would seem to me, says the Rambam, Nicham Avelim comes first. Why? Because Nicham Avelim, Gimila Chesed Imachayim V'mameisim. When I visit a person who is sitting Shiva, when I am Menachem Avel, so I am doing a Chesed not only for the Avelim, which I guess seems obvious, but to the deceased as well. That there's the presence of the Nifter in a way that we can't necessarily fully appreciate using our senses. And this, says the Rambam, is achieved when a person is Menachem Avel. Now tonight we're not talking about Nicham Avelim. That's the topic for next week. But from the perspective of the Avel, to understand and appreciate that it's not all about the Avel at this point. It's really about, just as much about the Nifter as well. The Gemara in Modern Katanav Chof tells us, how do we know that there's a concept of Avelus of Shiva? Now it happens to be there are examples from the Torah. The Torah tells us that there are individuals or people who observe the period of 7 days of mourning. But the Gemara in Moed Katan says, what's the source for this? And the Gemara quotes a fascinating source, a pasuk from Amos, which says, V'hafachti chagechem le'ezel. This is not a happy pasuk. This is not a cheerful one at all. I will transform your festivals, your happy times, into avelos. And the Gemara basically says, Machag Shiva af avelos Shiva. Just as Yom Tov typically is 7 days, of course, Shmini Atzeres would be an exception to that, but Sukkot is 7 days, and Pesach is 7 days, so too avelos Shiva. It's also 7 days. Now this is quite remarkable, and actually a little bizarre, because if we would think about it, it's true, 7-7, but other than that, they have nothing to do with each other at all. To the contrary, we know that when a person is experiencing the avelos of Shiva, or even Shloshim, and then Yom Tov comes, Yom Tov doesn't merely suspend the Shiva, the Shloshim, but it completely cancels it, it wipes it out, it overtakes it completely. So, we're not going to discuss why at the moment, but they're incompatible. And over here the Gemara says that the source of avelos of Shiva comes from the fact that we have 7 days of Yom Tov. So obviously there's a deeper message here. And perhaps that deeper message is that the purpose of Shiva, the goal of Shiva, is ultimately to allow for a transformation to take place. That a person should emerge over those 7 days inspired in some ways, and the process of mourning and ultimately consolation is to be enhanced through that experience. Much like Yom Tov, which is not just the time when we take a break from work and we, you know, entertain ourselves with a couple of new mitzvos before we get back to our regular life. Moed, the concept of Yom Tov, is supposed to be a break in time in which a person disconnects himself from the regular world and connects himself to a spiritual world. Ultimately, with the goal, with the hope and expectation that that person leaves the Yom Tov different forever, or at the very least, for the months ahead until the next Yom Tov. Many of the Mefarshim explained that's what the word Atzeres means. The Torah refers to the last day of Pesach and the last day of Sukkot as being Atzeres. Atzeres is a moment where a person stops and tries to take it all in, because I have to take it with me. And the Gemara may be telling us that that experience, that process, that transformation that takes place on Yom Tov is similar to that which takes place during Shiva. Rabbi Maurice Lamb, who we've quoted from a couple of times, who's written not just one but two books on Avelos, writes, a person should not commemorate or remember the trauma of death for more than a given amount of time, so as to not strain the mourner's mind to retain an active memory of that death. We cannot progress, even survive, if such memories hung around in our acute awareness. They would paralyze us, freeze us of all life, and one to an hour, and we cannot, or probably one to another, I'm sorry, we cannot then make the transition back to living, surely not transcend the death or become transformed and re-energized. But the goal of mourning, the goal of Shiva, is to help a person, to hold a person's hand, but pull a person from a sense of despair, of loneliness, of feeling that all is lost and all is over, and begins to realize that there's a process where a person needs to become re-energized. Now we're going to talk about some of the particulars having to do with the process of Shiva. Now, the first thing that happens when a person comes home from the cemetery, last week we spoke about the burial, and we got until the point where a person, I guess, gets in the car to leave and goes home. When a person comes home, so there's a special meal, a traditional meal that is served at that time, that's called the Sudas Havra'a. The Shulchan Aruch writes in Yardei Hashem and Ayachet, Ovel Asur Lecho Mishalo B'Suda Rishona. That the first meal that an Ovel eats is not to come from his own food, rather, he should be fed by friends and neighbors. In fact, the Gemara Yerushalmi tells us, Amru Kavo Me'era L'Shcheinov Shetrichu L'Kach, which means that neighbors, friends and neighbors of a person in an Ovel, who do not take the initiative to serve food for this first meal called Asudas Havra, are to be cursed. Be cursed. Why is this so important? After all, I come home from the cemetery, the last thing I want is to be bothered by other people, just give me a few minutes alone, and let me make my own food the way I like it. So Rabbi Olowelski, in the book, The Mind of the Mourner, I think explains very beautifully. I'd like to read you what he wrote. The logic of this halach is clear. In their moment of intense loneliness, it is unthinkable for the mourners to return to an empty house. The community must be there to feed them. The mourners are distraught over their loss and no interest in eating, hoping to die themselves. Their friends are there to tell them that life goes on. that strange as this may seem to them now, they will want to eat, that they are part of the community that deserves to support and nurture them. Indeed, a curse on the neighbors if they desert the mourners in the hour of need. And just as the community may not abandon the mourners may not retreat from the community. They may not reinforce their sense of isolation by eating of their own. They are obligated to reach out to those who are obligated to be there for them. In the Jewish tradition, being comforted is an essential expression of mourning. Very profound. But the key over here, which I think is so important, is to understand and appreciate that the process of avelus, as ordained by halacha, requires a person to be part of a community. I'm sure that you've heard this from many, and perhaps you've experienced it as well, but I know that I've heard it from many individuals, that often, during, sometimes after Shiva, a person will say, you know, halacha is just brilliant. It's just brilliant. And sometimes people say no more, and sometimes they explain and elaborate, that if I were, you know, sort of left my own judgment, I would have come home from the cemetery and gotten in bed and gone to sleep for a couple of days, just to have to, you know, sort of bear the pain that I'm feeling alone. And then maybe after a couple of days, I would have a conversation with a close friend of mine. The last thing I want to do is start seeing friends from high school and start reconnecting with people I haven't seen a lot. I need this time for myself. And that's a normal, understandable human reaction. And the halacha, in a sense, does not afford the person that opportunity to go ahead and experience this alone. Because first of all, their loss is not just a personal loss, it's a communal loss. And the experience of recovery is one that is greatly enhanced if and when a person can experience that with others. Now again, tonight we're not talking about Nicham Avelim. And hopefully next week we'll spend a lot of time talking about all the things that one should not say when visiting one who is mourning. And there are times people get it wrong, and I'm sure people have their own Shiva horror stories about the time somebody came in and made them, you know, more miserable than they were before. That could be. But ultimately, the process is one which is designed to really, really help a person move forward immediately in a way that allows them to experience this. It just occurred to me, and I'm sure, again, it's not coincidental, and we're not going to talk about this right now, but I've often remarked in the Sheva Brachos how strange it is that the Chazon HaKalos, who were just, engaged for a long period of time, and of course, the wedding is a moment that they've been looking forward to for so long, and you would think that the halacha would now afford them the opportunity that they've waited for to go immediately on their honeymoon, and to just be able to spend at least a week alone, as is commonly practiced, I believe, in most of the secular world. And here, we find that very often the Chazon HaKalos is spending the first week after their wedding eating with their parents' friends. Like, it seems like some sort of sick joke. Like, what is going on over here? But I think the halacha is reminding the Chazon HaKalos, this is not just about you. This is not just about you've just experienced a great, happy moment in your life. But when the person gets married, they're entering the Kalav Hashem, as the Torah says. Lo Yavo Mamzer, Lo Yavo certain people, but Kalav Hashem, this is more than just a personal celebration. That's why a chassan, he comes to shul, during the week of Shev Rachos, the whole shul doesn't say Tachanun. Because this is a communal experience. And Avelus, in a sense, should be a very similar process. Some of the practical aspects of the Suda Tabra, upon returning to the home, Avelim partake of a special meal called the Suda Tabra. This is consists of food that's prepared and served by others. Traditionally, the Suda Tabra begins with bread, sometimes bagels, because they're round, and lentils or hard-boiled eggs. Of course, the common denominator, they're all round. Many of you are familiar, we're not going to go through right now the reasons for this, these menhagim, but this is traditionally part of that meal. If a person doesn't like eggs, you don't have to eat it. It's not like me eating matzah and pesach, but this is traditionally what is served. Very important. I don't know, people sometimes don't know this. Meal is literally served to the avelim. Namely, after washing the avelim weight, and the bread is placed directly in their hands, and the eggs are peeled for them. This is, again, this meal only is to be served in such a fashion. Symbolically, again, it sort of underscores that which is happening over here, and that is that we are giving you of our own. You're not alone. By the way, if I'm not mistaken, it is for that reason why it is customary for people not to pass bread to each other. You know, that Shabbos, let's say, at the Shabbos table, You know, you're supposed to put the bread down. You don't put it in someone's hand. Some people actually fight them. I think it was a minute to throw it. I think you're not supposed to throw food, but, you know, to toss it gently across the table. So what's going on over there? Why don't we pass bread? So again, like very often, you know, we whenever there's a minhag that's unique to Avelos, we try to, you know, differentiate between. I remember my grandmother, Allah Shalom, used to always give me a hard time for walking around the shoes with my socks. You know, this is, you know, I'm sure many of you have your own memories about this. I think today it's pretty common accepted people walk around with this. But, you know, people will tend to be a little superstitious. They, you know, this is for an Avel. So here as well, we put the bread directly in the hands of the Avel, but otherwise we don't. It is customary that other close family members partake of this meal, not only for the Avelim, only on the same day of the burial. So if, let's say they came home from the cemetery at night, there's no requirement for Sudas Avra on the formal sense. Obviously the Avelim can eat, and the food can come from neighbors. Often that's the case anyway the entire week, is food that's coming from other places. We also don't do it on Erev Shabbos, Erev Yom Tov, later in the day. Following the Sudas Avra, the Avelim did not form a Zimun, and they recite the regular Berakos HaMazon. There are certain Siddurim that have a special text for the Berakos HaMazon, but I think the prevalent custom today is just to recite the very, you know, the regular benching without a Zimun. For the balance of Shiva, however, the benching could be recited together with the Zimun. Now, one of the customs in a Beis Avel is that a candle is lit in the house in which the Nifter was deceased, even if the Shiva will be observed elsewhere, remains lit for the duration of Shiva. Preferably, it should be lit in the house in which the person passed away. That could be lit in addition to a candle that's lit in the house of Shiva will take place if that's going to be in a different location. Really, the candle should be lit, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, when a person passes away. Most people don't have 7-day candles in their house. I mean, hopefully not. I mean, you know, what are you keeping it for? You don't have. I happen to have a stock in the office, because every once in a while somebody leaves a funeral home and give it to them. Okay, so I have, but usually people don't have it in the home, so you could light any candle. You could light a yardside candle, just any candle, and it could be burning until you have a Shiva candle, which could be lit afterwards. If the candle continues to burn after the conclusion of Shiva, it should be allowed to burn out rather than be extinguished. In a situation where it's Yom Tov, we tell a person to take the candle to a different room, but also allow it to burn out, but it shouldn't be burning there in public. The accepted practice seems to be that the candle is lit in the Beis Avel and remains burning throughout the Shiva. Okay. Sort of said that already. I'm sorry for that repetition. Traditionally, the mirrors in the house in which you have Avelim will stay during Shiva are covered throughout the week of Shiva. Now, it's a question what the source for this is. There is no mention whatsoever in early traditional sources, not the Gemara, not the Shulchan Aruch. This custom seems to have evolved relatively late in history, the last 100 years or so, maybe a little more than that. There's a fascinating article, if you're interested. I don't expect that you're going to write this down, although you may. But on the Chakira website, there are journals that have been published for the last few years called Chakira. So it looks like over here from volume 13, there's a great article, and he proves or suggests, as many do, that this is actually a modern, form, if you will, of an obligation which is found, or tradition found, which we won't see today, Kfiyas Hamita. Because I'll speak about the inverting or turning a bed over when a person is in Shiva. Today we don't have the types of beds, thankfully, which really lend themselves to that. I mean, there's no practical way for most people to turn the beds over. And so we don't do that today. There's suggestions as to what that represented and how maybe covering a mirror accomplishes the same thing. I guess it's probably obvious to most, this doesn't mean it's so, but that maybe the reason why we cover the mirrors is because we are emphasizing that at least during this week, we're focusing not on the vain aspects of life, not on our physicality, but on our souls, on the soul of the deceased, and the fact that we are all spiritual beings. And rather than spend time looking in the mirror and fixing my hair, so I'm going to, you know, focus on things that are ultimately more important. Now, I can't tell you for certain that this is the reason for the custom. Even if it's not the reason, it's a nice message, which I think is true, and it fits well with the idea that we cover the mirrors. Now, some practical points regarding setting up a Beis Avel. At times, it is beneficial to reconfigure the room that will be used for davening or nicham aveilim in order to maximize the space. Aveilim should welcome the efforts of friends, members of the Chabad Kaddisha, temporarily do this. I say this because, in my experience, there have been times when people have been reluctant to do so, and they want to keep everything as is, and it's not always practical to do that, and it doesn't make more sense. and sometimes people regret it, and a couple of days later, then try to do it on their own. So one, if they find themselves in this situation, should welcome the efforts of people who can think a little more clear and have the wherewithal and are in a state of mind to be able to sometimes do this temporary moving around. Many food deliveries are often made to homes during Shiva. There may be an excess of food, which is often happens. But sometimes people don't have the refrigerator space. So the question comes up, can I bring it to my neighbor or to my, anywhere else? And the answer is yes, you may. And not only that, if the food leaves the Shiva house, it can be consumed by others. You can bring it back later. It is true that there are people who have, sort of superstitious concerns, mystical concerns as to why they don't want to take anything out of the Beis Avel and bring it back in. The food is not tamei. The food is not impure. The food is not treif. Food that was prepared for Shiva that is not finished on Shiva can be eaten later. It can be frozen. I can't speak about this enough right now, but I say over there, it is preferable that the food be removed and stored elsewhere rather than be discarded. The prohibition about hashchis, and how unfortunate that would be if people take the time to prepare food that's good and edible, but I just don't have the ability to consume it all in one week, so you save it for later. If there are any pictures that are positioned directly facing where the assembled menu will stand, they should be temporarily moved, covered, or repositioned. This is not the kind of thing that people always know. Often, it is the case. When you're diving in someone's house, they have pictures all over the place. You don't have to start moving all the pictures in the house, but all things being equal, that's something that should be considered. If there are pets in the home, other than fish.
Pictures of people or anything?
Yes, pictures of people. They should be removed from the room, which will be used for davening and nichum aveilim. Again, maybe obvious to some, and maybe others wondering why. What's the big deal? But it's not appropriate to have pets walking around the room. It's a distraction. It's not an appropriate distraction. It sometimes can make visitors uncomfortable. And that's just a practical point that you will not find in Shulchan Aruch for pretty obvious reasons, I think. I think the most common household pets that people had 500 years ago were farm animals and probably didn't stay in the house anyway. But this is just a practical point, some of the things that, you pick up on over the years. As far as the actual restrictions, actual practical points regarding Avelis. So number one, there's a prohibition of doing Malacha. An Avel is prohibited from engaging in any work-related activities, as they will undoubtedly distract him from his Avelis. Another should not engage in any business-related discussions, phone calls, or email. Every effort should be made to arrange for coverage of work before Shiva begins. There are certain individuals, certain professionals, emergencies come up. I guess the best example, not necessarily the only example, would be a physician, not necessarily on call. Hopefully accommodations can be made during Shiva, but situations come up where, let's say, a patient doesn't know, or an emergency situation, needless to say, could take such a phone call. And even if it's not a life and death, you can pick up the phone, but the idea is that really should try to disassociate himself. And over here, we find a difference actually between the first 3 days and the remaining days of Shiva in this regard. When it comes to Malacha, we're a little more strict. I'm not suggesting that after the 3 days, one could actually start taking out his work and attend business meetings, but we find the Halacha more strict in this regard for the first 3 days. In a situation where one is concerned that will suffer a monetary loss, so then one should seek halacha counsel. That is, it's unusual in my experience, but sometimes it does happen. There are unique situations, and one should inquire. Regarding rechitza, bathing, an avel is prohibited from showering or bathing his entire body during Shiva. This is so even using cold water. An avel, on the other hand, may wash his face, hands, and feet using cold water. The water doesn't have to be freezing, but it should really be cool water. Note, by the way, that's different than, let's say, Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, where we say that a person should not wash himself at all. For the 7 days of Shiva, not as strict, that Panav Yadav Raglav, one's hands, feet, and face can be washed with cold water. Washing other parts of the body is prohibited, unless there's a medical need. The prohibition is limited to what's called Rechitza Shel Tanug, which means for pleasure. That doesn't mean intense pleasure, but most of us, when we go to sleep at night, we wash ourselves, take a shower, take a bath. It's not necessarily the most pleasurable experience on earth, but we do so not because we're filthy. We can do so because it's relaxing, because it makes us feel clean, it makes us feel better. That's called Rechitza Shel Tanug. Therefore, if you're dirty, you can obviously remove the dirt from your hands. Again, just like perhaps a more familiar frame of reference on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. Similarly, if an avil has perspired a lot, so he can wash himself, if necessary, remove the perspiration. One who feels extremely uncomfortable due to these restrictions, should seek halachic guidance, because there is an exception when it comes to rechitza for a person is what's called an istinus, also called sometimes a mufunak. A person is very particular. Obviously, if somebody has certain psychiatric conditions that make it particularly cumbersome for him, that's certainly in that situation. But even if a person is typically not OCD, if you will, but just having a really, really hard time, so the halacha does make an exception in this case with regarding nistinus, and there are some poskim who are particularly lenient in this regard because they say that everybody today, when it comes to this, is really nistinus, meaning most people shower every day. That's just pretty common, so therefore for the average person to go an entire week without showering is very difficult. There's no category, at least if you ask me, I wouldn't say across the board that everybody can shower on Erev Shabbos. Usually what happens when someone asks me, unless it's actually Erev Shabbos ready, so I'll say, let's talk then, we'll see. My experience, usually people don't ask. Maybe because they're afraid what I'm going to tell. They call it another rabbi. Or just once they're there ready, they say, okay, I just only have two more days. I'll stick it out. I'm sorry? No, but it doesn't have to be a freezing cold shower on either. Yes?
Absolutely.
I mentioned earlier, if there's a medical need, even if it's not a serious need, that's also not considered rechitza shenatanus. An oval may brush teeth and rinse with mouthwash, that's not considered rechitza. Sicha, which means anointing, an oval should not apply lotions, perfumes, other topical ointments, again, unless there is a medical need. An oval may use antiperspirant, a deodorant. Some of the books on Avelis will tell you it should be unscented. All right, listen, I don't know that you have to buy special antiperspirant for Shiva, but, okay, I could hear it. After all, it seems like perfume, but really, I don't think that's necessary. Gel or mousse should not be applied to the hair. A woman should not apply makeup during Shiva. These are all examples of sticha. Again, usually people can live with this. This is not such a big deal. Nilas sandal, removing of leather shoes. The novel should not wear leather shoes throughout the period of Shiva. This is not a din in leather, it's a din in leather shoes. If a person has a leather belt, you have a leather yarmulke, you have a leather jacket, you can wear leather, but you should not wear leather shoes. On the other hand, if you have shoes that are comfortable and they happen not to be leather, according to most poskim, it is permissible to wear those. A novel should not wear a shoe that contains any leather, whether in the sole, oops, at least I caught it. Okay. I guess in the context of this discussion, I can get away with that. Okay. Okay. Fair enough. And others permitted to wear shoes made of other materials, even if they provide the equivalent comfort to a leather shoe. I mentioned that already. One who is medically required to wear leather shoes for additional support is permitted to do so. So, again, time doesn't allow right now, but I will share with you just to whet your appetite, but without the details. And maybe you've heard this from me in other contexts, because I've shared this before, that there's beautiful hashkafa that's discussed about why we don't wear shoes at a period of Avelos and in Yom Kippur. And intuitively, most people think it's just a matter of comfort. This is a way that we sort of deprive our bodies of a basic comfort. And there may be some truth to that, but there seems to be a lot of evidence that that's not so. The fact that we don't wear shoes, for example, in Harabayas, and when entering the temple mount, one moves shoes as well. We find in the Torah, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu the first time, he says, take your shoes off, Yeshua would find as well, that this is protocol when one is standing in a holy place. So it's clearly not just about comfort. There are deeper ideas, very beautiful ideas. What it basically comes down to, just in a nutshell, is the fact that when we wear leather shoes, what we are showing is our dominion over all of nature. Because the ones we're on the top of the food chain, literally, and we basically have conquered the world and run the world. It's true that if you were alone in a room with a lion, you'd probably lose. But all in all, mankind has figured out a way to build a beautiful world, despite the fact that there are some pretty dangerous predators out there, and we are able to for the most part contain them. The greatest demonstration of dominance over nature as when we take an animal and we kill it and we take its hide and we walk on it. It's a demonstration of tremendous gaiva, and not necessarily in an inappropriate way. To the contrary, that's really the mission of mankind, milu ares v'kivshua, to conquer the world. But there are certain times where a person is told to remove his shoes to remind himself that, you know what? You're not in charge. You're not in control. We do that when we're in the presence of the Shekhinah, Har Bayis, we do it on Day of Yom Kippur, and Ovel as well reminds himself of his inability to really ultimately control his surroundings in that way. Tashmi Shemitah, marital relations, when Ovel may not engage in marital relations throughout the entire period of Shiva. When either the husband or wife is observing Shiva, they should refrain from any affectionate physical contact, including sharing the same bed. I don't want to get into details right now, but sometimes people do ask if it's permissible for a husband and wife to give each other a hug. And the answer is maybe. I mean, it really depends on the situation and the nature of the hug. It's not clearly defined. It's certainly not quite the same as when a woman is in need, in which case the lines of demarcation are much more clearly drawn. Other hachakos, for example, that are normally applicable when we need to, do not apply over here. So whether it's passing or other casual physical contact, do not apply. A woman who's observing Shiva does not immerse in the mikvah during that week. So if a woman is scheduled to go to the mikvah during a week of Shiva, she would postpone that until the week has concluded. Talmud Torah. This one is somewhat peculiar. You know, after all, we're not used to being told, don't learn. But an avel is prohibited from studying Torah throughout the week of Shiva. This is so because the pasuk says, "B'kuvi Hashem Yisharim Misam Chelev," that Torah brings a person simcha. The prohibition applies to all areas of Torah, including Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat Peh. Remarkably, this is something that's noteworthy, although not something that I'm encouraging other people to do, unless you feel that this sort of fits for you as well. But if I'm not mistaken, I remember hearing or reading that Rav Soloveitchik, and maybe he wasn't the only one, but actually would learn Torah while he was in Shiva. How do you explain that? Do you justify that? After all, the halach is that an avel doesn't learn. So the Rav explained that the Gemara says that an avel doesn't learn because learning brings a person joy. However, the Rav said that when he would deprive himself for such an extended period of time of learning, it would actually cause him tzar, cause him pain, and that's not required. You're not required to impose tzar pain on yourself, and therefore he was more hetter for himself. Fascinating. It says obviously a lot about the Rav's love for Torah and his devotion to Torah, but also about the perspective of a postek on these matters. And Avil is permitted to study Sefer Iyov, Megillas Eicha, some of the tragic descriptions of Sefer Yirmiyahu, the laws of Avelos, the third chapter of Moed Katan, which deals with it. So in other words, even a person who is thirsting for Torah, there is what to look to study. The shul traditionally gives, we have a traveling case of books, kind of velos, halacha books, and books in hashkafa, and those are all appropriate for reading during Shiva, obviously, we wouldn't send them otherwise. If needed, an avel may reply to a halachic inquiry without elaboration or explanations. An avel can recite Tehillim, if they are said as a tefillah, but they should not be recited for the purpose of study. Somebody, interestingly, an avel who is accustomed to learning Shnai Mikra V'Yachatarum, is permitted to do so on Shabbos during Shiva. That's a fascinating halacha. It's not really so much a din in Avelos, but it's fascinating about the importance of Shnai Mikra V'Yachatargum. What could be the reason for that? After all, an avel, even during Shiva, on Shabbos is not permitted to study Torah. Why would we say Shnai Mikra V'Yachatargum is permissible? Okay, so the answer that's given is because a person who reviews the parsha regularly, as one is supposed to, that, of course that's a key in Talmud Torah, but that's part of his regular routine. That's like davening. That's part of his stay there. And so therefore it's viewed as a component of his weekly rituals, more so than just, Torah study in the most literal traditional sense. Yeah. I'm sorry? It should be put up to Shabbos, because maybe that's the eco time to do Shnai Mikra anyway. Yeah.
So with regards to Torah study, this only applies to Shiva.
Yeah, all of this is Shiva.
So this is after burial, so if there's something in a eulogy or something like
that. Yeah, well, I mentioned last week that even though an Onan can't study Torah, but a preparation for eulogy is permissible. So he wants to open up a sefer to find a thought, an idea that's appropriate for eulogy, that is permissible as well. In addition to the prohibition of studying Torah, he should refrain from reading other books. That's what we're going to mention that later, actually, separately. Obviously, an avel can read other materials, personal letters, family pictures, and stuff like that, that facilitate discussion and invoke memories of the nifter. She'ela shalom, offering greetings. An avel should not offer a greeting to any individual, nor is anyone to extend a greeting to an avel. Greetings include shalom aleichem, good morning, hello. A simple nod of the head towards an avel is permissible. Even if the avel receives a visitor who travels a long distance, he should refrain from extending a formal greeting. An avel should not greet or stand for his Rebbe or any other distinguished individual. however he may offer a slight gesture or motion indicating that he would stand if he were permitted to do so. It is prohibited for a visitor to initiate conversation with the Avel before first receiving a cue from the Avel himself. We're going to discuss more details of Nihum Avel next week, but this is just within the context of Shela Shalom should be mentioned. And finally, it's permissible for the Avel to thank those who have come to offer the condolences. That's not included within the prohibition of Shela Shalom. Interestingly, the prohibition, I mean, not many people know this, and frankly, even for myself, it's hard to remember, especially for accustomed to greeting people with a nice Shalom Aleichem when we see them, but it extends beyond Shiva. It goes into Shloshim, and for a person who's observing Avelus of Yud Beis Chodesh for parents for the entire year, really not supposed to say Shalom Aleichem to an Avel.
No.
Most of them, if you ask them, probably tell you that they do get a Shalom Aleichem here and there, because, you know, a year is a long time, and it's not always on people's minds. Yeah.
What about the convert that they don't greet, in other words, they greet other people? What about a situation where somebody comes in to the Menachem Avel, and it's somebody who doesn't necessarily understand?
Yeah, one has, you know, obviously you have to use your common sense in these situations, and if there's a person who would be put off or insulted, I've seen it. I've seen it often. You know, colleagues from work come in, and, you know, they're sometimes a little awkward, and they've been there before, and they don't know, and they come right in, and they give them a big hug. So obviously the other is going to sort of play along, because, you know, that's appropriate, especially in that situation where how could they know? It's not just, that they were absent that day. I mean, it's just not part of their whole experience. They don't know. So, okay. But even in situations where people should know better, an Avel has to use their, you know, better judgment in situations like that. Again, I'm also going to sort of hold off till next week to discuss, you know, how to navigate your way through, because there are many things that happen typically in Shiva houses which shouldn't. And there are, you know, I have some thoughts about how maybe to redirect people in situations like that. Kibbutz v'gihutz, which means laundering. And Avel is prohibited from washing clothes during Shiva and from wearing freshly laundered clothing. If an Avel's clothing becomes soiled, he may change them. However, one who is observing Shiva for a parent and has to change a shirt has to tear Kriya again. So, if the shirt's dirty and uncomfortable, he should change it, but you have to tear Kriya again. On Shabbos, an Avel may wear freshly laundered garment. Yeah, that picture got messed up. It was supposed to be with the previous one. You know, I can't always get the technical stuff right. Yeshiva Gabikarka, we sit on the floor. An Avel should sit on the floor, or at least within 3 tefachim, which is considered to be the floor. That's the idea. It's not that you're supposed to sit low down. Really, the Avel's supposed to sit on the floor. We just say that if it's within 3 tefachim, that's like sitting on the floor. That's the concept of a Shiva chair. Shiva chairs obviously have gotten much more comfortable over the course of time. Some may remember cardboard boxes, and some of them are egg crates, and then the first version, Shiva chair 1.0, which was a wooden chair, but it was, you know, and then they got really comfortable to the point where I've heard people say, you know, is this okay? Is this against the spirit of the law? So as far as I know, the answer is, yeah, it is okay. But a person who would say, you know, I just don't feel right, I wouldn't say that the person's crazy, like, what, you know, but they are comfortable. Often, even these chairs are uncomfortable, especially the position, the person's lower back starts hurting, so it's certainly not the most comfortable thing in the world, but a week's a long time to be sitting on the floor. An elderly person, or anyone experiencing significant discomfort from sitting in this position, they sit on a regular chair, and the requirement to sit low down only applies when sitting. If a person is standing, or a person wants to lie down, that's completely fine, and there's no reason not to. And the accepted practice is that Avel may sleep in his normally accustomed fashion. You may recall that on Tisha B'Av, there's halacha that you should diminish your comfort while sleeping, taking away the pillows, or if you sleep with 2 pillows, you 1 pillow. On during Shiva, we don't have such a restriction when sleeping. It's really only when sitting. And again, it's not clear that this law is all about comfort. You know, again, intuitively, I think that's what we say in our minds. We say, oh yeah, this is the Avel supposed to feel uncomfortable, but that's not necessarily true. It may just be simply for the purpose of, you know, distinguishing between who's who in a Beis Avel. There are certain people, I believe, you know, sit with the Avelim on the floor. They're all different customs. Okay. Personal grooming, such as shaving and taking a haircut and cutting nails, is prohibited during Shiva. Actually, it's prohibited during Shloshim as well. It is permissible to comb one's hair. Following Shiva, a woman may shave body hair. The prohibition of cutting one's nails applies to fingernails and toenails. The prohibition only applies to using a nail clipper, a scissors, so a person can trim his nails with hands or teeth. A woman may cut her nails in preparation for immersion in the mikveh. And again, one who finds it completely, significantly uncomfortable should, again, seek halakhic counsel in this regard. Again, I don't actually keep data on this, right? I've never run some formal study, but I can tell you, in my experience, you know, this is sometimes what people complain about the most. Not complain, but, you know, is there anything that can be done over here? You know, I'm going crazy, my nails are so long, I'm not used to this. You know, so it's interesting that, you know, this is something that a lot of people find difficult when in this situation. And Avil should really not leave the home. It's really prohibited normally from leaving the home during Shiva, taking a walk, one should not do. If he has to go to sleep elsewhere, he's permitted to do so. There's nothing wrong with that. If a person is traveling in the middle of Shiva, sometimes people go from one home to another. I did not include in this discussion how to make that decision. I have thoughts on that, but again, this is just one of the things that just make it, but, you know, how decisions should be made as to where Shiva should be. Actually, it's an important discussion, so maybe I'll try to stick it in next week. And whether families should split up or stay together or in two places or one place. But the bottom line is, if a person is going to finish the Shiva in another location, obviously he can leave his house at that point. Another can leave the house on Shabbos, traditionally is done. If a person feels the need to step outside, should go through the back door or the side and not, you know, stand, you know, near and with other people. There are times where a pressing need arises, a person feels that he has to go somewhere. There are unique situations that sometimes come up. Recently somebody was telling me about a person who unfortunately lost a parent and could not share with the surviving parent that the other parent had passed away and had to visit maybe once or twice during Shiva as if nothing was going on, because hearing the news would be too difficult for the surviving parent to bear. So that's obviously a very difficult situation. In that situation, it would obviously be warranted for child to get up from Shiva temporarily to visit the other parent. In keeping with the spirit of Shiva, this is very important. Again, maybe obvious, and forgive me if some of these examples are actually offensive, they're not obvious, but I wouldn't mention them if I didn't think that they should be mentioned. The other should refrain from reading pleasure material, reading the newspaper, watching TV, engaging in any form of personal or social correspondence. People sometimes get text messages or emails which are Shiva related. You know, not everybody can always get up and make a Shiva visit. So I think it's okay to respond within that context, but to actually have social correspondence talking about other things would not be appropriate. Playing with a child, even one's own child, is something which should not be done. If the baby's crying, needs to be held by his mother, that's something else. But obviously, when we hold children, it brings us a lot of delight and makes us feel good and it's a distraction. It's precisely for that reason why it's prohibited during Shiva and listening to music. As you all know, there are different types of Shiva homes. There are times where everybody in the home is completely distraught and the situation is so tragic, and it doesn't have to be said that you shouldn't read the newspaper. It's obvious. But then there are other types of Shiva homes where a combination of factors, including the fact that the death wasn't a sudden, it was expected, and you know, person had been grieving for a very long time, and maybe there aren't a lot of visitors. You know, there can be several factors which could make the week very long and, forgive me, maybe even boring. And maybe it's not as obvious that one should not read the newspaper if it's sitting there anyway. But remember what we said earlier, that the process of Avelus and Shiva, Nicham Avelim, is not just a Gemilas Chesed for the Avel, but for the Nifter as well. We should be mindful of that and try to avoid what's called a Hesach Hadas. You know, we speak about Hesach Hadas when it comes to the Hilchos Brachos. A person has a lapse of thought about something. That we have that same concept when it comes to Avelus as well. That a person should try to remain focused on, you know, why would it there to whatever extent possible throughout the week. Shinui Makom, there's a minute that an Avel changes one seat from his permanent seat during the Avelus. There are different opinions regarding this practice. Here at Beth Aaron, in this community, the minig is that an Avel changes seat on Shabbos only during the period of Shloshim. It would change for the entire week, or the entire year during the week, but on Shabbos only during Shloshim, that's the minhag. An avos should move to a seat away from the Aron Kodesh, farther back to the side. And I'm just adding this, but it's an important point. Needless to say, every effort should be made to locate a new seat that would be no less conducive for proper davening than where he was at beforehand. Similarly, his new seat should not interfere with his ability to daven next to younger children when applicable. Right? Common sense has to prevail over here. And if one had a certain seat beforehand that worked for him, and now that he's, you know, an avelus and he's changing his seat, he finds that he can't stop talking during davening, you know, you're not doing anyone a favor in that situation. We're not talking about Kaddish right now. Kaddish is recited when a person's in avelus. But as the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says, we'll get to this hopefully in 2 weeks, Kaddish is that's offered for people who can't do anything else. Kaddish is like, okay, everybody can say Kaddish. That's an easy one. But says the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the way a person conducts himself in every other way is profoundly more important. A person's midos, the way a person treats other people, mitzvos in general, and obviously conduct in shul in general is profoundly more important than a person saying Kaddish. How ironic it would be and sad if a person was very, very careful to say Kaddish, and as soon as Kaddish was over, he went to talk to someone. Completely, completely missing the point. And again, I hate to be so blunt, but not doing a great favor to the father and mother's soul in heaven. Really not. Probably causing tremendous distress. Avelus on Shabbos. On Shabbos, an avel refrains from displaying outward or public observances of avelus. We sometimes think, mistakenly so, that avelus gets canceled by Shabbos. Yom Tov cancels avelus, not Shabbos. Shabbos suspends avelus from the perspective of the menachemim, other people who will be looking. From the avel's perspective, only the outward appearances of avelus are suspended, but the private restrictions, v'chitza, tashmish, shamitza, talmud Torah, those things apply as well. An avel can begin to prepare for Shabbos within a reasonable amount of time before the onset of Shabbos. An hour or two is what people should do. Is permissible for an avel to make early Shabbos during Shiva. An avel does not recite Kabbalah Shabbos, but does say Mizvah Shir upon coming to Shul. As you know, it is traditional that an avel who comes to Shul on Friday night, they say Amokim Menachem. Some of the customs refrain from saying Shalom Aleichem in a base avel. However, Eish Yischiel and all the other mirrors can be sung as normal. There is also Nobrech Sabanim. Those who bless their children Friday night don't do so in Avelus. At the conclusion, an avel goes home, usually davens Marvin home, and immediately they're reciting Baruch Hu, removes his leather shoes and should change out of his Shabbos clothes right after Marv. Okay, very briefly now.
Shabbat Shalom.
So really should not.
Shabbat Yiminachim.
Again, I don't. You mean to a person who sees an avel during Shiva?
Yeah. No, Shabbos.
Yeah. Just take his hand. I think so. I don't know. Right. It usually happens. I mean, I'm in this situation. Every time there's another one comes around Friday night, so take his hand, and I think I usually say you should have a comforting Shabbos. That's just what comes to my mind. You know, maybe come up with something better. Shloshim, very briefly. It's customary to refrain from normal bathing during Shloshim. Nevertheless, the prevalent practice today reflects the very lenient position that the postcom of a generation adopted regarding this custom. Therefore, it's permissible for one to shower and bathe as needed. I still encourage people, it's a little more traditional in this regard, to decide for themselves what they can handle. But just like during the 9 days, we're all familiar with this concept that we limit the frequency, the duration, the temperature of the bathing in order to make it, you know, less of a rechitza shatanic experience. We should still try to maintain that during shloshim. It's very hard for me to be more machmir than Rebbe. My Rebbe, Rebbe Willig, is very lenient in this regard, but, you know, I'm sure he wouldn't object if a person, you know, felt that he, he was okay limiting the bathing during Shloshim because Mikra Adin, that's the way it should be. One should try to avoid wearing freshly laundered clothing and iron clothing during the Shloshim. However, just like we have this concept during the 9 days, somebody else could put on the clothing first in order to, you know, to break them in a little bit. Also, one should refrain from wearing new clothing during Shloshim. After the Shloshim, a person is warning for a parent, is permitted to purchase only new clothing when there is a need. Otherwise, one should refrain from such purchases throughout the year. How do you decide if there's a need? So some of you have heard me say this before. The answer is, it's up to you. Right? That's another tradition that I have from Rebbe Willig, who says that you don't tell people what they need. Because some people say, I've been wearing the same suit for the last 25 years, and I don't need a new one. Is he wrong? No. And some other people will tell you, I've been told this by people, I get a new outfit every Yom Tov. And therefore, you know, if you do the math, you probably have 3 closets full of beautiful outfits. So, but he said, but I need another one. So, do they need it? So the answer is, if they say they need it, they need it. I'm not going to tell you what you need. I'm going to tell you that the halacha says you should not buy clothes during Yud Beis Chodesh unless you need it. But there are times when there really is a need. Somebody, loses weight, you know, in a good, healthy way, hopefully, Baruch Hashem, wonderful. So now you need new clothes. Somebody gains weight, they also need new clothes. Clothes get ripped. I mean, things happen. That's life. Sometimes we need new clothes. Another should not take a haircut, a shave, his facial hair during Shloshim. That's limited to a man, his facial hair. A woman may remove facial hair during Shloshim. Additionally, other, what's so funny? That was on a joke. Additionally, an Avel may not cut his nails during Shloshim. One who's mourning for parents may not take a haircut until people begin to tell him he looks like a mess. And now, we all have nice friends who wouldn't just come over to us and say, you look terrible. So, if you want to clarify the definition of flexibility of this law, so you should seek halacha counsel again, because, you know, there may be a certain point where we say, okay, you could take a haircut, even if nobody's told you how terrible you look. The novel is required to refrain from participation in public celebratory gatherings or other social events that bring a person towards a significant enjoyment. That's called simcha mereyus. The definition, parameters, and applications of this restriction are somewhat subjective, and one may discover some degree of variability between different communities. I deal with this all the time. When someone's in Avel and he asks me for, you know, protocols during the year of Avelus, and he has siblings in another community, sometimes another shul right down the block or right across town, and they're getting different answers. So what's going on over here? We only receive one Torah at Sinai. So the answer is very simple. You know, the Shulchan Aruch gives us a rule, but we live in a very complex world, a world in which there are so many different types of gatherings and get-togethers, everything from real simchas, like a wedding and a bar mitzvah, to, other types of simcha gatherings, like a sholem zachar, and then you have, of course, people make a siyum, and people have graduation parties, and parties for adults, and parties for children, and end of the year, Hakaras HaTov gatherings at work, where it's not a meeting, but, you know, all these different types of things. So obviously, there's going to be a certain degree of subjectivity when it comes to determining what types of events are appropriate and what not. I try to give certain rules, which, again, I just couldn't fit in here right now, but, you know, I'm happy to discuss it, you know, in a public setting another time, but to help people understand guidelines as to how, you know, one should conduct himself during the year. Even though I said this is Shloshim, really just sort of stuck the Yud Beis Chodesh into this. For those of you who are feeling a little disappointed that we didn't discuss enough about Yud Beis Chodesh, it's really my intention at this point, I think, to talk about more of that in 2 weeks, the final segment of the series, and we're going to talk about memorializing the memory of Neshama, parents in particular, over the course of the year and beyond. So that'll give us an opportunity to talk more about this. Just in conclusion, we talked a lot about the halachos, the particulars of Avelos. What we didn't mention or highlight maybe clearly enough was that these stages of Avelos, first of Aninos, followed by Shiva and Shloshim, and for some Yud Beis Chodesh, so these are stages in which a person hopefully internally is changing as well and adapting more to the new reality, and therefore the halacha relaxes and adjusts as such. As well, traditionally, we believe that there are stages of transition that are happening for the neshama as well, that mirror this process. And so, you know, the word that we typically use when describing, you know, the transition for a soul is hopefully an aliyah, an ascent. You know, so there's an ascent after the shiva, there's an ascent after the shloshim. And, you know, seeing it in that way, you know, helps us, you know, puts a little more, again, I think more meaningful context to the entire process, as opposed to just seeing it as a sort of a rigid set of laws. Just conclude with a quote. This is only a one-page quote. Last week I had a 12-page one. It was a bit much. But this is, again, the Rav, again, once again, on Avelos and everything. But it's just so profound and so deep and so just really, you know, captures things in a way that, I can't risk ruining it by saying it myself, so we'll just read it together. Mourning, if observed with restraint and compliance with halacha, enhances the status of man. It is an experience of great dignity. It is a sacrificial act enlightening the sufferer as to the meaning of life as well as the destiny of mankind. This axiological critical analysis enriches his personality. It purges him of the ugly and contemptible in life. On the other hand, when man remains emotionally neutral, he loses a lot of his humanity. The animal is neutral. Man must not disengage himself from his involvement in the fate of his fellow man. Nevertheless, men must not react hysterically to pain and suffering. He must not surrender to them. He must act at a certain moment. He must, at a certain moment, be capable of rising from the mourner stone. It's supposed to be stool. It's what mourner stool, no matter how difficult it is. So the Rav explains again how the halacha tries to meet us where we are and bring us forward, encouraging us to maintain our emotions and live with them and be in them, recognize the fact that we are human beings and we have to mourn as humans do, but at the same time, pulling us from one step to the next, and by sort of concretizing the process and those emotions, hopefully enabling a person to, as he says, rise from the mortar stool to be able to achieve a greater sense of fulfillment going forward. Thank you again for joining us this evening, and we will continue to next week talking about the process, the laws of Nichum, Avelim, of consoling mourners.